From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A 12-year-old girl stabbed 19 times in a brutal attack by two friends of the same age. Motivated by the internet character Slender Man, they're now held in a juvenile detention center. In Steubenville, Ohio, sexual assault documented on social media sent two students to lockup. Minor crimes can mean incarceration, too, underage drinking, petty theft, and more. And violence in facilities where abuse is pervasive and nurturing relationships rare. Reformers have argued for change within prison walls for years. But reform might not even be enough of an answer. This hour on Point, inside our country's juvenile prisons and the bold case for shutting them down. Later this hour, we'll talk with former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton about her new book, Foreign Policy Crises and 2016. Joining me now from San Francisco is Nell Bernstein. Her recent book is Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. Nell, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, very glad to be here.
Nell, talk for a moment about what caused you to embark on this project, what you expected to find when you did, and what you concluded by the end of it.
Well, it's been a long journey. I spent several years reporting the book, but I spent a couple of decades before that working with teenagers, primarily as editor of a youth newspaper in San Francisco, and over those years, increasingly watching them get locked up. And in the great majority of cases, watching them come out damaged and angry and much more likely to create chaos and violence for the rest of us. So that brought me into it. I thought I was going to write a book about the things that were wrong with not the whole juvenile justice system, but what I call juvenile prisons, despite the many euphemisms we use, the large state-run locked facilities. What I found was that they were so consistently destructive, both to kids and to public safety, and had been since their very inception, that reform began to seem increasingly futile to me. And I wound up with the conclusion that we do need, metaphorically, to burn them down.
Let me first start with a little definitional work for our listeners. When you refer to juvenile prison, we all know of cases where juveniles are charged with crimes. They may be tried by as adults, and then they go to be incarcerated. Are we talking about facilities for those people, or do those young people go to adult prisons, and the juvenile prisons you're referring to are for another set of people convicted of crimes?
Yeah, that's a really important distinction. Since the 1990s and the whole super predator scare, we've been sending increasing numbers of kids, sometimes very young, into the adult system. So that means that if you've committed, you know, a serious violent act, you're very likely not in the juvenile system at all. Within the juvenile system, there are sort of a spectrum of facilities. There's group homes, there are county juvenile halls, and then there are the subject of my book, which are, you know, they could be called a boys' academy or a training school. As I said, there are many euphemisms, but because I found them to be prisons, they're what I call youth prisons.
But now, do they look, if someone not as expert as you were to walk through them, would they resemble a prison? Are there kids confined behind bars, or is it something that you're concluding that the totality of the experience is that, but it doesn't look like that?
Yeah, I probably shouldn't have put it that way because I've been in a lot of adult prisons for my last book. You drive up to the place and you see coils of razor wire. You are checked in at a guard station. You go through a series of gates. There's a sally port, a metal detector, sort of doors, metal doors clanging shut behind you. And then there are children in cells. So I'm not being metaphoric when I say that these are prisons. There really is not anything that I found to distinguish them from adult prisons.
And one other point to clarify, those kids who are charged with and convicted of the most serious crimes who go in the adult system and adult prisons, do you believe that that is appropriate, or is that encompassed by what you want to sort of rip out by the roots and start over with?
I don't think that it's a wise response, but it's a reality that we're dealing with. It's not the subject of my book, but no, I think that sending a child into an adult prison is really not that different from sending a child into what resembles an adult prison, and certainly is no wiser. So I don't think that's the solution, no.
Talk for a moment about how you see kids being damaged and spit out of these facilities at the end of their confinement in worse and more dangerous circumstances than when they went in.
So there are two ways to talk about that, and one is through stories, which is primarily what I do in the book, and the other is through research and facts. So I'm going to start quickly with the research frame, and then I'd love to get to talk about some of the stories. But one thing that really surprised me was to learn that in confidential interviews, 80 to 90% of all American teenagers or American adults acknowledge having done something as teenagers that could have got them locked up, but they haven't been. And when researchers look at matched groups of young people, those who got a pass or weren't arrested, and those who were channeled through our juvenile prison system, the latter group is twice as likely to go on and wind up criminals and prisoners as adults. So that tells me right there that this is not only an ineffective but a destructive intervention. And then there are the abuses that have been well documented and that I've seen and had described to me by young people, which really explain why this experience is so damaging.
Now, one thing we've seen in the debate over criminal justice generally is crime rates have come down. You have a government that is pressed for money. You've got people on the left who have been concerned for some time that the way that in the adult system, mandatory minimum sentences and things of that nature had swelled the prison population, especially for crimes that weren't violent, beyond what was reasonable. And now there's talk about letting some of those people out early. Is there a corresponding political move toward at least partial steps of the kind that you're talking about in terms of overhauling juvenile justice and juvenile prisons?
Absolutely. In fact, I think the movement is even more powerful on the juvenile side. We've seen a 40% drop over the course of about a decade in the number of kids incarcerated. So that's very significant and promising, really. The problem for me is that the 60% who remain still, for example, face a 1 in 10 chance of being sexually assaulted by a guard, about a 1 in 3 chance of being physically assaulted or going through some kind of a violent restraint. And all of them experience the damaging effects of complete isolation and the severance of all family and community ties. So it's promising, but I by no means think it's time to rest on our laurels.
Nell, I want to go to our phone lines because we've got some calls. Kirk is on the line from Groton, Connecticut. Kirk, go ahead. You're on with Nell Bernstein.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. And this book you have is sounds amazing. I spent 3 weeks in Manson Youth Institute in Connecticut when I was 17 years old. And they had, everybody referred to the place as Gladiator Camp. There were fights daily, multiple fights daily. And, the reason I was there was I had taken a couple of tires off of a friend's car to pull a prank. And, a neighbor had called the police, and I was arrested for criminal mischief in the third degree. And the judge wanted to show me, I can quote him as saying, "I want to show you what the legal system is like." And he put me there for 21 days, and there was no form of rehabilitative services in there at all. And it was after the period where the Department of Children and Families had supposedly taken the place over to improve things, and the only marked improvement I had heard of was they increased the meals to 4 meals a day from the 3 that the adults got.
Wow. Kirk, that sounds like a terrible experience. I'm sorry that you went through it. Nell Bernstein, how typical?
Well, profoundly typical. And I'm not sure how old the caller is, but I could hear the emotion still in his voice. And I hear that over and over. It never goes away. And when he talked about what brought him there, that's what I mean when I say 80 to 90% of us. And, you know, let's be honest, folks, and look back at our own adolescence. And I think most of us, even if we think we were very clean, did something that could have wound us up in that situation. But it's interesting because I'm from California, and we use the phrase gladiator schools as well, because not only are there a lot of fights, we've had a long-term investigation as part of a lawsuit, and it turns out that in our facilities, board correctional officers were essentially instigating fights by putting people from opposing gangs into cages and betting on the outcome of their fights.
Wow.
Videotapes of dogs being set on unresisting boys. So across the country, these things are happening.
Nell Bernstein, we'll be right back with you after the break. We're talking about juvenile prisons and the call to end them altogether. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. Later this hour, our conversation with former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Right now, we're talking about the fate of juvenile prisons, the issues surrounding them, and whether or not they're beyond repair. We're talking with Nell Bernstein, author of Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prisons. And joining us now from Chico, California, is John Caudill. He's assistant professor of criminal justice at Cal State University, Chico. He's worked with juveniles as a correctional officer. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi.
I want to start off this segment by playing some sound that was from a CNN news report. March of 2013, two teenage boys in Steubenville, Ohio, were found guilty of raping a 16-year-old girl, sentenced to a minimum of 1 year in a juvenile facility, as well as having to register as sex offenders. After the guilty verdict was announced, the defense attorney for Malik Richmond told Piers Morgan on CNN the verdict was too harsh.
I don't believe that a person is 75 years old should have to explain for something they did at 16 when scientific evidence would support your brain isn't fully developed. When the evidence in a case would suggest that you were under the influence.
Listen, I've got 3 teenage sons, and when you get to 16, 17, your brain's developed enough to know you shouldn't be raping girls.
Well, there are people that know better than you that would disagree.
Well, I don't think so, honestly. Well, I think you get to 17, you're a late teen, you're nearly a man. You know?
Either way, would you want to be judged for the rest of your life for something you did at 16?
Nell Bernstein, how should the fact that someone in that period, as Piers Morgan said, almost a man but not a man, how should that play into our notions of justice for those people and rehabilitation for those people?
Well, it's interesting because the Supreme Court has spoken on that question in a couple of recent decisions, not outlawing life in prison, but outlawing mandatory life in prison for offenses committed by juveniles. And they do cite the same brain research that the defense attorney referenced. It turns out that the human brain isn't fully developed until 25. And I think, again, if we look at ourselves, am I the same person I was at 17? I don't know. I wasn't going around creating havoc, but I'm a very different person now. And I think that all people are asking is that when that kid, who is a very small percentage of those who we lock up, the great majority of kids are locked up for acts more like the first caller described. But when a kid does commit or is involved in a very extreme act, that there's a chance for a parole board to look at him again in 10, in 20, and in 30 years. And no one is saying if he's still dangerous, he should still get out. But if we're going to use words like reformatory or correctional institution, we have to have some faith that they can reform or correct. And these mandatory long sentences really fly in the face both of what we now understand about the adolescent brain and that fundamental American faith.
John Caudill, Nell Bernstein described a process of researching this book that sort of radicalized her on this topic and led her to think that you couldn't reform and save juvenile prisons. You had to get rid of them and come up with something new. How do you feel about that prescription?
Well, I mean, it's a, I mean, the whole idea of incarcerating children and such is it's provocative and it tugs on the heartstrings of parents. I'm a parent and I understand that. I don't want my children locked up and things of that nature. But the reality of it is we have to take this in context with the behavior of the individuals and how they ended up where they're at and things of that nature. Is there room for reform? I mean, I think throughout history we've seen that reform is a regular practice. But is it such that that we can put these kids back out on the street? I'm not sure that we want some of these offenders back on the street given their criminal history and their behavior. And so to metaphorically burn down the house is it's provocative. I just don't know if it's realistic.
You think it's a step too far?
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, let me just clarify one thing. John, you think it's a step too far, correct?
I just don't think it's realistic.
No?
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, I think he may be right about that politically, although a 40% drop is pretty significant. But the thing is, if a kid is in the juvenile system, he is going to be back on the street. I mean, that's my concern. I'm concerned about the kids, but I'm also a parent, and I'm concerned about public safety. And if the evidence is, and it is, that locking a young person up for anything in a juvenile facility doubles the chances that he's going to go on to commit more serious criminal acts in the future, that actually undermines public safety. I mean, maybe for that period when he's incapacitated, he can only hurt other people who are prisoners. But I also, you know, I've followed the Slenderville story, and I mean literally followed it on radio a few times now. And I also worry that we make policy based on these really outlying cases when the great majority of the kids we're locking up, even in state facilities, are there for nonviolent, non-dangerous acts.
Let's bring our another one of our callers into the conversation. Rob is on the line from Lexington, Kentucky. Rob, welcome to the show. What's your question or comment?
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. I did some volunteer work at a juvenile correctional facility in Virginia, which truly lived up to its name as far as corrections and rehabilitative work. They did a lot of great work with the kids. No razor wire, none of that, like Nell described. Tragically, in my opinion, it was shut down in 09 or 10 after the economy collapsed because of funding. So it was, I guess I just wonder Nell's opinion, if there was some middle ground for facilities like that, in her opinion, that truly did rehabilitative work. Again, with the acknowledgement that this was a place that was shut down when budget cuts came through.
Yes.
Now, how would you distinguish between places that are trying and doing a decent job and those that are much worse?
You know, I think when you see them, it's as the gentleman said, it's very easy to make that distinction. And I did visit places like that and talk about them in the book. The clearest example is the state of Missouri, which has the lowest recidivism rates by far in the nation. And none of their locked facilities hold more than about 40 kids. So they do lock kids up, but they don't imprison them. They put them in a locked building for as long as is necessary. And during that time, they really provide them with rehabilitative services. But I think just as importantly, there's somebody working with the family. Because, you know, a lot of kids come into these facilities already having suffered a lot of trauma themselves. So if there's nobody working with the family and they go back to the same family and environment, again, it's not surprising that we have these really negative outcomes. But Missouri is really the place that a lot of states are trying to replicate and where you see kids being locked up but not imprisoned.
Let's go to another call. We've got Amado on the line from Austin, Texas. Amado, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I would like to respond to the gentleman that said it's preposterous to close them down. One, what are you going to do when they all get old? Are you still going to maintain them? Are you still going to care for them? And number two, Everybody's talking about the problem, but they're not talking about how to really solve the problem, which is there's a company called, I think, Correctional Systems of America, and that company, I think, manages and builds and runs 90% of America's prison system, and also the lobbying behind this corporation or these corporations for this type of rehabilitation is really strong on there. I think that what we need to do is more about the second point would be to sometimes the sentence does not fit the behavior. Sometimes the sentence is on the ceiling, while the crime is not even off the ground floor.
Amato, have you ever had personal experience with this system?
Yes, 90% of my mother's side youth are at one point or the other when we were growing up were incarcerated, including myself, for about a year. I mean, the sentences are ridiculous because the judges, they're supposed to judge, but they're not judging.
Treatment did you find in the facilities yourself?
What sort of treatment?
Yes.
Well, the treatment is a stigma that stays with you forever. I mean, you're locked up like in a cage. It's not about fighting. It's not about the way they treat you, the way they talk to you. It's physical. And so at that point, you have to really bring in some big guns to rehabilitate that person. I mean, yeah, there's all kinds of things going on in there. There's fights, there's abuses, there's, you name it. It's like you're worse inside there than if you would be outside and poor. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense.
Amato, thanks so much for your call. I'm very sorry for the difficulty that you had in those facilities. It sounds like a terrible story. John Caudill, Amato seems to be making Nell Bernstein's point.
Yeah, I mean, there's always the opportunity for everybody's perception to lead that direction, and I'm sure that that his experiences were obviously traumatic for him. The reality of it, though, is that Neil mentioned some research on the effects of incarceration or detention for juveniles and later recidivism and things like that and other outcomes. And we, along with some of my colleagues, such as Dr. Chad Trolson at University of North Texas and Matt DeLisi at Iowa State, we've looked at some of these things. And to be honest with you, what we find the majority of the time is that there's a continuity of behavior. The behavior that landed them in the detention, the behavior while they're there, and then the detention once they leave, or the behavior once they leave detention. So you have to take into consideration the behavior of the individual.
But doesn't
Nell
that
Bernstein,
tell us that
continuity of behavior?
Absolutely,
how important.
Because the negative behavior is reinforced by this intervention. I mean, that seems like an argument. Can I just finish the sentence?
Sure.
It just seems to me like an argument against an intervention if it takes some negative behaviors, fails to correct them, often exacerbates them, and returns kids to the street to continue those behaviors. I'm not sure what value we're getting for between $88,000 and $225,000 a year.
John?
So, as far as the evidence, the scholarly evidence, the academic evidence on this stuff, you can cherry pick studies that say one thing or the other, but when you look at all of the evidence, there's pretty strong evidence, even going back into the 60s, of an individual behavior is there's a continuity of it, and that it's you can't just say that the intervention is worse because there's a lot of other factors involved. I think it's irresponsible to only look at a few studies and not look at comprehensively at the issues.
All right, we're going to go to another call. We've got Aubrey on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Aubrey, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. I'm going to try and get this all out, my points that I want to make. When I was in my late teens, I worked in the New Hampshire State Hospital I was an aide with the criminally insane while they lost their accreditation. And we had, for instance, we had 660 men in that, in my section, the criminal section, and one psychologist at the time. But and some of these were kids. And from that job, I went to, I ran a group home for special needs kids. And then I got a job in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I opened a gym in the projects in Cambridge, Mass. It's just a project, predominantly black and Hispanic. And they gave me 6 basketballs and the key to the gym. And within a month, I was servicing 150 kids. And a lot of the agencies that I had applied to jobs for that didn't hire me because of my education ended up coming to the gym to get kids to put them in preventive programs because I had so many kids every day, average of 150 a day, one guy. But anyway, the point I wanted to make is that I think the first step is preventive programs. I worked, when I was working at that gym, I worked with an agency in Boston called Youth Enrichment Services. And every winter, we would put 7,000 to 9,000 kids in skis right down in downtown Boston. They would come with the Boys Club or the Projects or whatever organization sponsored them. And it cost $7.50 per kid. We got students from Boston. We took them up to the mountains, gave them lessons, and put them on, in skis, which is a completely different world from what they were living in. It just gave them an opportunity to see something else. They did canoeing in the summer and bicycling. And we saved a lot of kids from a lot of this crap that they got to go through, you know. So, and then my next point is that the statistics that we're using today, a lot of, I can't think of any program, but I imagine a lot of the programs that the courts and the agencies involved in servicing these kids are using statistics, programs that were based on statistics back, you know, as many as 30, 40 years ago when there were less than 200 million people in the country. And they're using the same percentages, and now we've got 318 million people.
Aubrey, thanks so much for your good work and for your call. Nell Bernstein, two things. One, can programs like the one, the preventive programs that Aubrey mentioned, make a big difference? And B, are we hobbled by bad or outdated information about this problem?
Okay, so those are two questions. The answer to the first question is absolutely. I mean, there were studies, for example, on the midnight basketball leagues that were started a decade ago, and crime went way down just when kids had an opportunity to do something besides hang out on the street. And, you know, I see it in my work and in my life. I have 13-year-old twins, and I look at what they do in the afternoon. You know, they swim, they go to the park, they play sports. I go into the neighborhoods of the kids I'm writing about, and there's just nothing. Nothing. And when there is something, for example, when we opened the doors of our youth newspaper, they just cling to it. And this does include kids with very serious criminal records. If we want to talk studies, the programs that are called evidence-based, because they have the strongest evidence base, are things like multisystemic therapy and functional family therapy, where you don't lock a kid up, but you assign a caseworker to, A, connect the child to the kind of programs the caller was talking about, and B, work literally around the clock with him and his family to resolve the issues that led to the act initially. And I'm sorry, I've forgotten the second part of your question. Statistics.
Actually, Nell, we have run out of time. I'm going to thank you for being on the show. Your new book, Burning Down the House, The End of Juvenile Prison. Good luck with that, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
John Caudill, criminal justice professor at Cal State University Chico, thank you for being with us.
Yes, sir, and look out for Lost Causes with the University of Texas Press next year, looking at the continuity of behavior for these offenders.
Coming up after the break, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. She hasn't declared, but she's the 2016 presidential frontrunner. And the world is overflowing with what she spent 4 years handling as President Obama's Secretary of State, Hard Choices, which happens to be the title of her new book. Joining me now from New York is former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Madam Secretary, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. It's great to talk with you.
I'd like to start with simply the range of problems facing us in the world. Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Ukraine, Gaza. I'm well aware of the propensity for an out party to look at events like that and say the party in the White House is to blame for all of it. The party in the White House says, well, we can't control events in the world. But how much responsibility should the Obama administration accept, and should you accept, having run foreign policy for 4 years, for the chaos that we see right now?
Well, John, that's why I wrote this book, Hard Choices, because I really want to give people an inside account and demonstrate some of the imponderables and intangibles that go into making these hard choices so that Americans, you know, have a look behind the curtain, so to speak. I'd answer it this way. I think that one of the main points I make in the book is that we are living in a much more complex, fast-moving world for many reasons. Obviously, the end of the bipolar world with the collapse of the Soviet Union, which I think we're still, you know, trying to adjust to and manage, the increase in non-state actors, terrorist groups first and foremost, but also other players for good and for bad, the rise of technology, which has been overall a real positive, but which has empowered all kinds of people and groups. And so I think it doesn't do us much good to point fingers at each other. What we should be trying to do is reestablish a bipartisan consensus on foreign policy that requires America to demonstrate leadership, to be deeply involved in trying to do what we can to manage these crises. I negotiated the last ceasefire in Gaza, November 2012. It lasted until this month. I fully support Secretary Kerry's efforts to try to end the violence once again. But look at what happened in just 2 years. You had Hamas getting access to much more technologically sophisticated missiles to launch at Israel. You had the very serious problem of the tunnels. You had a change in leadership in Egypt that we certainly had nothing to do with, the overthrow of the Muslim Brotherhood President Morsi. So you constantly have to be evaluating where can we make a difference. But the one big lesson that I hope Americans are taking from this is when we back off or step away, that doesn't it doesn't bode well for either managing or resolving a lot of these disputes.
But, Madam Secretary, is that a longer way of saying for Americans who are looking and saying, well, do we want the party that's controlling foreign policy now, or do we want to make a different choice when we move forward in elections? Is that, are you saying to them, these problems are not to any degree our fault or my fault?
Oh, well, I'm saying that, you know, every administration, every party in the White House has the responsibility during the time it's there to do the best we can to lead and manage the many problems we face, and I think we did in the first term. I think if you look at what we accomplished, number one, restoring American, you know, leadership and reputation after inheriting two wars, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and a collapsed economic system, I think that President Obama's leadership and those of us who were his partners did a great deal to, you know, move us forward in the right direction. The pivot to Asia was necessary because many of our Asian friends and partners thought the United States had basically walked away from being a presence in the Pacific. I brought about three face-to-face meetings between Netanyahu and Abbas in an effort to continue to push for a two-state solution, but the United States can help facilitate but not dictate to other peoples what they should be doing for their own self-interest. But we never stopped working, and I think it's not just the headlines, John. It's what I call the trend lines. Not only reestablish our reputation and our leadership, but beginning to do more to try to improve conditions around the world that affect women and girls, because that's not just a nice thing to do. That's very integrated into our foreign policy objectives, because where women are treated fairly and equally, you're likely to see more stability, more democracy, less insecurity and terrorism. I think there was an enormous amount accomplished in the 4 years. I mean, I know I wrote a long book, but
yes.
I cut about two-thirds of it out.
let's talk about Russia for a second. There is a line of criticism that the president's reset didn't work, that he was played by Vladimir Putin. You point out in your book, of course, that when George W. Bush, with the doctrine of preventive war, was president, he seized parts of Georgia. I guess my question is, you say in the book that America can't solve everything, but nothing can be solved without America. We're the indispensable nation. If neither approach, their administration, the Bush administration or the Obama administration, worked with Putin, what exactly are we indispensable for?
Well, I would take issue with the way you characterize that, because what I think I demonstrate in the book is that the reset worked. It was an effort to try to obtain Russian cooperation on some key objectives while Medvedev was president, and of course Putin still, you know, pulled the strings, but he gave Medvedev a certain amount of independence to negotiate, number one, a new arms control treaty, which was absolutely necessary. The Bush administration had allowed the treaty to lapse with respect to mutual examinations of missile sites and other important locations. So we knew what the Russians were doing, something that I believe strongly in. We brought Russia around to understanding why we thought there needed to be international sanctions against Iran. I'll never forget the meeting that we had, the president and I, and just one other person on our side, and Medvedev and two on his side, where we told him that we had evidence, conclusive evidence, about Iran building an underground facility at a place called Fordow. And the Russians were shocked because they thought they knew what was going on in Iran. So we brought them to the table at the Security Council. We got those tough sanctions, and we eventually were able to get to the negotiations that are going on now with the hope that something real can come out of them. We got support from the Russians to go across Russia to resupply our troops in Afghanistan. The reset was a device to try to refocus attention on the transactional efforts that we needed to get done with the Russians. Now, when Putin announced in the fall of 2011 that he was coming back, I had no illusions. I wrote a memo to the president. In fact, I wrote two memos to the president pointing out that we were going to have to change our thinking and approach. We gotten all we could get from the reset. But the reset succeeded, but we had to make adjustments given the fact that Putin was going to resume both the real position of presidency and begin, I thought and argued, to be more aggressive in his foreign policy.
Let me go back to Gaza for a second. First of all, are you pleased that the FAA reversed its decision after complaints from Mike Bloomberg and Prime Minister Netanyahu and allowed flights, U.S. flights, back into Tel Aviv, even though many European countries have not?
Well, a number of Europeans have reversed their policy as well. Look, I think it needs to be based on the best understanding of the circumstances, and I think that the FAA received additional information about steps that Israel has taken. From my understanding, with the reversal here and then the reversal in a number of European nations, they're basically sending a message out to passengers that we're going to keep a close watch on this, and you know, you'll have to be aware of you know, potential changes in plans as we go
right
forward.
So I'm a Methodist, as you are. You say in your book that you were inspired to go into public service by the Methodist faith, do as much good as you can for as long as you can. The United Methodist Church yesterday signed a letter saying enough with other religious organizations. It said that the underlying cause of the resumption of violence after repeated ceasefires is what they called the legal, structural, physical violence inherent in Israeli siege of Gaza and the West Bank. Do they have a point? Are they right?
Well, I'm very proud to be a Methodist too, John, and very grateful for my lifetime involvement in the church. Of course, they have a point. There are always arguments that can be made that have merit to them, but I think that particular analysis right now misses what I believe to be the central reason why this conflict has once again flared up, and that is the desire by Hamas not only to assert itself, since it feels it's got its back to the wall, it doesn't really have any very many friends left in the region, thrown out of Damascus by Assad, basically losing their relationship in Cairo. And I think they're doing it out of both a calculation that they can engender more sympathy and support for their cause, but also to put Israel on the back heel. And I have no doubt it was a deliberate provocation. Now, I do think that if we can get to another ceasefire, which I think is going to be difficult because Hamas wants to hold out for all kinds of substantive negotiations, which will be, you know, very difficult to negotiate and agree upon in the kind of time pressure that a ceasefire requires, then issues like greater access to Gaza for you know, food and other materials can certainly be taken into account. But I think in this particular case, I think the responsibility falls on Hamas, and I think they knew exactly what they were doing, which was to try to, you know, put Israel in this position and try to gender some sympathy because they don't really have any support much anymore.
Another thing you say in the book, when you're describing your role as Secretary of State, you said it includes the policy element, but it also involves being the CEO of the big, vast State Department apparatus. Every 4 years, when people run for president, governors say you ought to elect a governor because we've run things, we know how to manage. Are part of the problems we're now seeing under the Obama administration, both in foreign policy and domestically, a function of the fact that their leading figures, President Obama, Joe Biden, you as Secretary of State, were legislators who came out of the Senate, not people who had run things before?
Oh, you don't expect me to agree with that, do you?
I think what's wrong with it?
Well, look, I think it depends upon the individual. I had serious disagreements with George Bush, and he was a two-term governor. So, look, I give...
But is there a management deficit in this administration?
I think there is a political deficit in Washington because of gridlock and opposition to the president that started the first day he went into office. And I find that so regrettable. You know, I don't want to sound, you know, naive or Pollyannish about it, but I think we've got two big crises in our country. And one of them is the economic crisis, which we all know has just dramatically increased inequality and stagnated middle-class incomes and outcomes. But we also have a political crisis. Our democracy is not working, and I don't see how we're going to resolve a lot of the issues. Look at, you know, if you look at the reforms that the president has put forward time and time again that would make the government more manageable, move it into the 21st century, you know, they're just met by a solid wall of resistance.
Right. Let me get to a couple of things real quick before we run out of time. You mentioned reform. Paul Ryan's out with a plan today proposing that states be allowed to take all of the programs for those in need in one revenue stream as a way of finding better ways to make them work. Is that a good idea?
No, not in the current atmosphere. It is not a good idea. All one has to look at is the nearly half the states that refuse to expand Medicaid to realize why it's a bad idea. If states won't even take what are very generous terms from the federal government to give working people and poor people access to health care, how can we turn over all of the resources that are meant to assist those in need. I don't think that.
Okay. The Jeb Bush, former governor of Florida, is out with an op-ed calling for comprehensive reform, as you do, but saying that the law his brother signed and that passed when you were in the Senate in 2008, the William Wilberforce law, ought to be changed to make it easier to send those other than the deserving few back to their home countries in Central America. Should that law be changed?
Well, I think it should be looked at as part of an overall package. We have two categories of people that are represented by these poor children that have come across our border. We have migrants, you know, children who are leaving for a variety of reasons, economic, they want to reunite with family members, and we have refugees, people who have reason to be threatened, people who have bad, you know, probabilities if they return home as to what might happen to them. So we do need more resources very quickly deployed, which is what the president and the
right.
Democrats have asked for. We need some flexibility within the laws. The laws, our laws right now are not particularly well suited for, you know, making the kind of determinations that are required and that we should, as Americans, want to see happen.
Last question, Madam Secretary, before we run out of time. It's about you and the press. Jill Abramson, my longtime boss and friend, said recently Hillary Clinton has terribly unrealistic expectations for journalists. And my question for you is, have you been so scalded by your past interactions that it makes it difficult for you to communicate in the way that you would need to as a presidential candidate or otherwise?
Well, I don't think so. I think maybe one of the points Jill was making is that, you know, I do sometimes expect more than perhaps I should, and I'll have to work on my expectations. But I had an excellent relationship with the State Department press that followed me for 4 years and enjoyed working with them. And I, you know, whatever I do in the future, I look forward to having the same kind of opportunities.
Secretary of Clinton, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. Good to talk to you, John.
I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.